Thank you very much for those very kind words. It's very much my pleasure to be here. I hope that a handout was distributed. I'll be able to follow, presumably, what I say without it, but I think it'll be aided if you do have the handout. Every semester at Notre Dame, I teach the first required class in theology to our incoming undergraduate students. My habit has been to use the book of Genesis as a window into the Old Testament. But as soon as we reach the story of the flood, my audience grows restless. God sees how wicked humankind has become and promptly declares, looking at text one here on your handout, "I will blot out from the earth the human beings I have created, for I am sorry that I have made them." What kind of God would wipe out every living thing with one sweep of a hand, my students ask. Can I put my faith in such a vindictive figure? I don't need Richard Dawkins to raise this problem. The students at Notre Dame see it with their own eyes. And things don't get much easier as we move forward. About a dozen chapters later, we come to the story of Sodom and Gomorrah and are faced with another episode of wholesale destruction. Quoting here from text 2, quote, "The Lord rained on Sodom and Gomorrah sulfur and fire from the Lord out of the heavens, and he overthrew those cities and all the plain and all the inhabitants of the cities and what grew on the ground." And then, if things weren't bad enough, there's always the book of Exodus we just heard a reading from. After God has witnessed the Israelites build the idolatrous golden calf, immediately after giving them the Ten Commandments, he flies into a rage. "Now let me alone," he says to Moses, "so that my wrath may burn hot against them and I may consume them, and of you I will make a great nation." This proposal sounds eerily close to what God did in Noah's day. Though God had sworn never to repeat such wholesale destruction, he escapes that requirement by a legal technicality. In this instance, God will destroy only a single nation rather than the whole world. Yet the similarity is sufficient to shock the sensitive reader. So the picture, at least at first, doesn't look too pretty. It's not just the judgment of the flood that creates a challenge, but it's the repetition. Genesis 6 is not some rare or random act, but appears rather to be something constitutive of God's character. Ironically, as I hope to suggest this morning, it's in precisely this repetition that we'll find the solution to the challenge. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. Let's linger for a moment on the problem. That is the challenge of Genesis 6. Part of the reason I think we're so bothered by biblical stories like this is that our understanding of mercy and justice is often naive. We've been shaped by what Philip Reif, Christopher Lash, and others have called a therapeutic mindset. One of the effects of this cultural demeanor has been a wariness of making strong moral claims about the nature of good and evil, specifically the notion that good should be rewarded and evil punished. A world shaped by the therapeutic process recoils at such moral absolutes. In the theological sphere, this has resulted in the soft peddling of stories like the flood and setting at center stage stories like the prodigal son. In short, elevating the merciful God of the New Testament over the quote-unquote vindictive God of the old. Now, I have nothing against mercy. Hopefully, I'll be the beneficiary of it at Judgment Day. Nothing against mercy, especially the sort displayed towards the prodigal son. But as surprising as it may sound, too much mercy can be just as dangerous as too much judgment. An excellent place to see this, and I always use it with my freshman students, is the award-winning television series Breaking Bad. My favorite series of all time. My wife can't watch it because it's too violent. I won't recommend it to you. It might not be for all eyes, but I've used many clips of this series in my teaching. The show is about a high school chemistry teacher who's suffering from terminal cancer and enters the drug world in order to support his family after he passes. He He partners with the figure Jesse Pinkman, who happened to have been a former student of his, who's familiar with the local drug networks. Now, by dint of circumstances we need not explain, Jesse is compelled to fire a bullet into the head of an innocent man. I have the text of this on the back of the handout here. We won't go through all of it, but this is the key scene. As the episode unfolds, we see that this act of cold-blooded murder has deeply disturbed Jesse. Not only does he struggle mightily to pull the trigger, but in the days that follow, the specter of this deed continues to haunt him. It is in the wake of this profound emotional crisis that he returns to his 12-step program, and the therapist asks Jesse how he was doing. Jesse confesses that he has, quote, killed a dog, a euphemism. Some members of the group try to soothe his conscience. The dog was suffering. Putting it down was a kindness. But Jesse waves this all off. He insists he killed an innocent animal. This honesty alarms Colleen, and she sharply rebukes Jesse. The therapist then intervenes. Colleen, we're not here to sit in judgment. But is there really no place for judgment? Maybe Colleen's right, Jesse argues. The thing is, if you just do stuff and nothing happens, what's it all mean? That's the crucial sentence. Kicking the hell out of yourself doesn't give meaning to anything, the therapist responds. But Jesse's unbowed. Should I just stop judging and accept myself no matter what I do? Hooray, I'm a great guy. No matter how many dogs I kill, I just do an inventory and accept. There are a couple things worth flagging here. Most of us unconsciously, I think, presume the rule of law. At the end of day, criminals get their comeuppance. We can go out about our business without worries. But a very different world exists below this civilized frame of reference. In the drug world, you can kill an innocent man and just walk away. And conversely, someone can kill you and go unpunished. This provokes for Jesse not just a moral crisis, but here important to underscore, an existential crisis. The thing is, Jesse asks, if you just do stuff and nothing happens, what's it all mean? What's the point? It's important to note that Jesse's rebuke of the therapist shouldn't be heard as a broadside against 12-step programs. Rather, the script writers here, I think, have used the non-judgmental presuppositions of these programs to criticize what happens when they become a general worldview. It's also important to emphasize that Jesse wants to be forgiven and healed, but for that to happen, his actions first must be condemned rather than waved off. Better than most of us, Jesse knows that the grace of forgiveness cannot be offered on the cheap. Those who commit murder must face the consequences of their actions. If we bear these thoughts in mind, I think the flood story looks quite different. What God sees when he surveys the world at the beginning of chapter 6 in Genesis is exactly what Jesse sees after he's committed murder. A world awash in violence with no judicial force to stem the tide. I think most of us would agree such a world would be, in fact, unlivable. As a result, God has to hit the reset button, so to speak, and create a new world from what he imagines will be better moral stock, the loins of Noah. But all is not well. One story later, human beings are back to their mischief, building the Tower of Babel. God sees the danger looming, but this time he's unable to send a flood. He does instead the next best thing. He mixes up the languages so that no single nation can exercise totalitarian power over another. This creates a check on unrestrained violence. Human wickedness can be controlled but not eliminated. But what about the story of the golden calf? However much we domesticate the wrath of God during the flood, God's return to such an overwrought emotional state would seem to present an unsurmountable obstacle. There is, however, a significant difference within these narratives. Though Noah survives the flood, he does so in a more or less passive manner. True, he built the ark and loaded the animals into it, no small feat, but he took no stance for or against what God had proposed to do. Not to put too fine a point on it, but we could say that Noah just went along for the ride. Looking at our handout there, chapter 8, verse 1, the end of text number 1, we read that Noah is simply remembered by God. But when we turn to text number 3, we'll see that Moses stridently demands that God remember his prior commitments. Remember, he says in verse 13, I have it in italics, remember your servants, Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, how you swore to them, etc. Moses has addressed the impending cataclysm very differently from Noah. To explain why, we need to look a little closer at the text. First of all, from the very beginning, Moses is taken into God's confidence and consulted about what is going to transpire. Had God simply wished to execute judgment, we'd have to rewrite what it says there in verses 9 and 10. The text should have said, I have seen this people, behold, it is stiff-necked, my wrath shall burn hot against them, and I shall consume them. That sentence, my rewritten Bible, expresses a unilateral divine action. But note carefully what God, in fact, does say. I have seen this people. Behold, it is a stiff-necked people. Now, therefore, let me alone, that my wrath may burn hot against them. In verse 10a, that I stopped on, now let me alone, God, as it were, requests Moses' permission before he proceeds. But not only does God request Moses' permission in this matter, but he also signals how Moses, in fact, should respond. For at the end of verse 10b, when God tells Moses that he's going to make of him a great nation, he's reminding his prophet of the promise he made to Abraham, the very father of the nation he's planning to destroy in Genesis 12. By framing his request this way, God gestures toward the most formidable argument that can be used against him. And Moses, recognizing this subtle hint, recalls the terms of that earlier promise. Verse 13 and following, remember, he says, Abraham, Isaac, Israel, your servants, to whom you swore by your own self. And when the Lord hears these words of his promise recalled to him, words that he was prompting, by the way, Moses to say, the text concludes, he renounced the punishment he had planned to bring upon his people. Moses had gone toe-to-toe with the creator of the universe and had won. A key feature of this narrative is the representational role that Moses plays. The great biblical scholar, one of my favorites of all times, Jewish scholar Yochanan Mofs, argued that Moses in this text is not simply an exemplary human being standing before God. He, in fact, Mofs argues, represents part of God to God. In fact, Moses assumes a part of the divine personality such that one cannot properly pick out the full identity of God by only attending to what the grammatical subject identified as God in the story says. The character of God here, in our key verses, Exodus 32, 7 to 14, and this is crucial, the character of God is revealed by the verbal exchange between God and Moses. God isn't just what God says. God is the combination of the two voices. Only in seeing that combination can we get a proper bead, Muffs contends, on who God truly is. Muffs captures the sense of our text when he writes, God allows Moses to represent in his prayer his own attribute of mercy, the very element that enables a calming of God's other elements of angry and vindictive feelings. Because Moses is a necessary and indeed non-negotiable element in the rendering of the identity of God, a later Jewish interpretation can go so far as to say that God himself wept when Moses was ready to hand his soul over to death. God says, according to this Midrash, who now will stand against me on the day of my wrath? Who will protect Israel in the hour of my anger? Who will speak up for them when they sin against me? Moses is a necessary actor in the narrative that depicts God's character. The identity of God would be different without him. The reader will naturally ask why the story has depicted God's identity in this peculiar manner. The answer, I would suggest, is that our author wants to establish the necessity of intercessory prayer. If one thinks about it, intercessory prayer is a rather odd affair. Does God really need to be remembered that my Aunt Myrtle is having surgery tomorrow? Wouldn't he prefer that I do something more useful than running over to the chapel and bowing my knee in prayer? Patrick Miller, one of my favorite biblical scholars, responds to this problem in a rather insightful manner on text 4 of your handout. Here he's commenting on how this process works in Psalms of Lamentation, but it applies perfectly to what we have here in Exodus 32. With our sense of the consistency of God's actions, our resistance to any ideas of whimsicality and the divine intention that makes God's will dependent on how urgently we press God and our dependence upon the model of Christ, not my will but thine be done, we properly hesitate to affirm the validity of such motivating and urging exclamations in prayer. There is, however, some legitimacy to these words and some connections with our own understanding of prayer. For one thing, they assume a theological perspective that's fairly widespread in the Old Testament, and that is that God's purpose and action are involved with and affected by the purposes and actions of those whom God has created. To be sure, God is independent of human control, but, crucial phrase, he's chosen to be responsive to the human situation. There's a kind of openness, a room for maneuvering, not just a willingness, but an intention on God's part to be accessible and responsive to creation without being dependent upon it and controlled by it. This openness does not introduce whimsicality, capriciousness, or inconsistency into the divine activity, nor do the motivational sentences of the psalmist, or here Moses, seek such. It's necessary to recognize that in these prayers, prayer is urging God to act according to what, in fact, is God's will and purpose. It is precisely because God's way and manner in the past has been discerned to be merciful to the suffering and delivering of the oppressed that the psalmist, or here Moses, can know it is right to cry out in the present. Then we see there's no inconsistency with that notion of not my will but thine be done, because these petitions and motivational expressions are consistent with what God's revealed about his nature. The psalmist's prayer, Moses' prayer, are in fact the will of God be done. There's an urging that God act as God. We can find this problem also addressed by the famous English Catholic novelist Evelyn Waugh, who captured this wonderfully in his Sword of Honor trilogy. During his father's funeral mass, here's text 5 on your handout, Guy Crouchback reflects on the problem of his own spiritual lethargy. Quoting here from Guy Crouchback, for many years now, the direction in the garden of the soul, put yourself in the presence of God, had for Guy come to mean a mere act of respect, like signing of the visitor's book at an embassy or government house. He reported for duty, saying to God, "I don't ask anything from you. I'm here if you want me. I don't suppose I can be of any use. But if there's anything I can do, let me know." And he left it at that. "I don't ask anything from you." That was the deadly core of his apathy. That emptiness had been with him for years, now even in his days of enthusiasm and activity for the halberdiers. Enthusiasm and activity were not enough. God required more than that. He commanded all men to ask. Waugh, I think, hits the nail right on the head. God has commanded us to ask. In other words, in his handbook for administering the providential order, God has assigned a crucial role to human beings. He needs our prayers, and it is this need that's on display in the story of the golden calf. With this in mind, I think we can cast new light on the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. In this text, Abraham, like Moses, is troubled by what God is about to do. He asks whether 50, 45, 30, even 10 righteous persons will be enough to spare the cities. God assures Abraham that even 10 will be sufficient. Later, after God has destroyed those cities, we can assume that there were not even 10 righteous persons there to be found. But the story does not end there. In Genesis 19:29, we read, "So it was, when God destroyed the cities of the plain, God remembered," Zachar in Hebrew, the same word we've traced through the flood narrative, Exodus, and now Genesis 19, God remembered Abraham, that is, he remembered his prayer, and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow when he overthrew the cities in which Lot had settled. The fact that God remembered Abraham recalls both God's remembering of Noah and Moses' prayer that God remember his promises to Israel. But what has God remembered? He was attentive to the one matter which Abraham did not mention in his supplication, the safety of his immediate kinsmen, Lot and his family. In other words, God remembered what Abraham was too humble to utter out loud. Before closing, let's take a look at what Pope Benedict XVI says about Moses' intercessory prayer. This is text 6, the top of page 2. He said this in his famous Wednesday audiences that were chock full of fantastic insights on various biblical texts. This particular Wednesday audience was devoted to the text we're reading today. Benedict had this to say: "As with Abraham in regard to Sodom and Gomorrah, so also now God reveals to Moses what he intends to do, as though not wanting to act without his agreement." Amos 3:7, God doesn't enact any judgment without consulting with his prophets. He says, "Let me alone that my wrath may burn hot." And Benedict here, quite independently of Yochanan Muffs, I'm sure he didn't read him, but here we have Christian and Jewish scholar being on the same page with respect to this verse. In reality, this "let me alone that my wrath may burn hot" is said precisely so that Moses might intervene and ask him not to do it, thereby revealing that God's desire is always to save. Intercessory prayer makes divine mercy so active within the corrupted reality of the sinful man that it finds a voice in the supplication of one who prays and through him becomes present where salvation is needed. As with the two cities in the time of Abraham, punishment and destruction point to the gravity of the sin committed. Very important, I think, sentence to underscore here. Mercy doesn't erase justice, going back to the concerns we saw in the TV series Breaking Bad. At the same time, however, the intercessor's request is meant to manifest the larger point, that is, the Lord's will to forgive. This is the salvation of God, which involves mercy, but together with it also exposes the truth of the sin, of the evil that is present, so that the sinner, aware of and rejecting his own sin, can allow himself to be forgiven and transformed by God. In this excerpt from his weekly address, we see the theme that we attended to in Breaking Bad, return with a vengeance. I mentioned there that Jesse, of course, doesn't want the cheap grace on offer within the 12-step program. He wants his evil actions to be condemned, but ultimately he wants them condemned as the necessary first step towards forgiveness. Though Benedict understands the back and forth between God and Moses as a form of intercessory prayer, he also recognizes that the threat of divine wrath reveals the true character of the evil that has been perpetrated. God's grace, as Dietrich Bonhoeffer so profoundly knew, is not offered on the cheap. It can only be offered once an honest appraisal of sin itself has been made. Let me conclude by reviewing the three texts with which we opened. The story of the flood, I suggest, puts us back in an era of time before time. This is not a simple historical narrative in the simple sense of the term. Rather, in this story, we see how God puts in place the conditions in which human life can flourish, one of which is the establishment of the rule of law. The episode from Breaking Bad, I think, at the secular level, reveals just how important this sense of the rule of law is for conducting a proper human life. Second, we saw that the story of the golden calf was both similar and different from the flood. Although it appeared as though God wanted to destroy Israel, what he really wanted was Moses' intercession. And that intercession, as I emphasized, should not be understood as an act of opposition to God, but rather as a participation in the mystery of his character. Recall what Muff said when we look at those verses in chapter 32, and we identify the subject, God. We shouldn't be limited to the grammatical subject of those verses, that God is only what God says. Rather, who God is in his full and complete character is the combination of what God and Moses say. We must avoid the error of Guy Crouchback and think that our service of God consists of simply signing the guest book and then being on our way. God, Waugh is careful to note, commands us to ask. And finally, we saw that the story of Sodom and Gomorrah is simply a variation on the issues presented in the golden calf. In summary, I think we can give a confident answer to the worries that I raised, my students at Notre Dame raise, about the just nature of God's character when he condemns and judges sinners. Does justice come at the cost of mercy? Scripture, I have tried to contend, at least this morning, answers with a resounding no. Thank you for your attention.